always a highlight for us when he visits on the program. He is, of course, a writer for Defector Media, the co-host of the Distraction Podcast. He is the spokesmodel for Gross Gas and a charter member of the Downtown Hall of Fame, David Roth. Hello, David.
Really innovating in the introduction space there. I appreciate that. So few people mention my modeling. He's on, you know, Twitter or whatever. He's got an mood disorder. But no one mentions my work in the print modeling field.
Well, listen, we try to cover all the bases here. Did you get your coffee mug?
I did, and I am treasuring it. Entirely too much to drink coffee out of. Right now it just sits by my computer. I will say that, is it known to the listeners what you get when you're inducted into the
Yeah, I think we have shared that with people, yes. Yeah.
So the coffee mug is, like, it's a really nice coffee mug, and eventually I'll either, you know, use it or put pens in it and look at it every day and remember the good times we had. The temporary tattoos, I'm not really sure when those are going to get used, but they're still there. They are on site, and then when I'm ready to use them or when I have a good location, I'll let you know.
Well, you know, that was, we did that with good humor. We didn't really expect. Carrie did a test drive of one. It looked pretty good on him. I'm reasonably certain Ken Burns is not getting one.
Yeah, I think the idea of Perry Gilpin just putting one on her neck, like Yadier Molina, is, like, it's nice to think about, but I don't think that that's probably going to happen. That said, it's great company. It's just cool to have a mug that's got my name on it and Roz's name on it.
Right,
cool.
There you go. And actually, I think Perry might put the tattoo on it. Would not surprise me.
Yeah, I mean, it's getting it made permanent there, where really you have to, like, talk to the various stakeholders in your life about, you know, is this the type of person that you want to become?
Right. That's a different level, and especially if you do it as the neck or the face tat.
Yeah, those are, I feel like that's become somewhat more acceptable, one of Post Malone's great gifts to the culture. I still feel like, though, at this point, I'm like more than halfway through my life and stuff. Yeah. I'm not really sure that it's time for me to begin iterating with the neck tattoos. I can ride this one out, probably get through the door without anyone really asking me why I don't have one.
I was thinking more like, you know, that Roger Stone tattoo of Nixon between the shoulder blades.
Oh, gosh. So I'm glad that you know about that, and I guess I'm glad that the people listening know about that, too. I hate knowing about that. It was on there's like a New Yorker story about him a million years ago, and it had a photo of him. And he's just not, he is very poorly drawn. Just in general, his proportions are all off. It's unconvincing. But then the photorealistic Nixon tattoo behind it's between his gigantic shoulder blades and directly below his perfectly pointed number two pencil head. It is just a really unsettling visual, and that is the art that leads that story. Tough stuff.
Oh, goodness. Well, lots to talk about today. Let's start with sports, and my goodness, NBA draft tonight. Do you enjoy watching the draft? Do you care? Do you like the spectacle of it all?
Yes, I do. But the thing that's been strange about it is, you know, it used to be, I guess this is part of just getting older, my friends and I used to get together and watch the draft, you know, and go to a bar, which is a very poor television for a bar, because it's like 75% people talking and like, you know, Mark Stein trying to explain to you, like, that this is actually, you're thinking of a different Bosnian, this is another Bosnian with the exact same name, who's the same height. It's, like, not great TV, but what I've noticed of late, like, I still do watch it, and, you know, like, I love the coverage. I've always admired, I got to edit him a few times. Sam Vecini is his name, who writes for The Athletic. He wrote a 160,000-word draft preview.
Wow.
That is, like, it's a book. It's, like, a 300-page book. And he's a good writer. He's just, like, obsessed with these guys. And so there's, like, this is the part of it that's harder for me, is that the guys that are good prospects in many instances, I like watching college basketball, are not the guys that, like, pop when you're watching a college basketball game. It's different with football for the most part. There aren't a lot of guys that, you know, eventually if you have the tools, you have to stay long enough, sooner or later you're going to notice, you know, that, like, even if you're splitting tailback duties at University of Alabama, at some point it's going to jump out to you that this person is an NFL player. A lot of guys that are the college players that are talked about at the top of this year's draft are guys that I barely saw because they spent like 1 year at Villanova, and Villanova wasn't that good this year. Or they're guys that are just sort of like Derek Lively from Duke is apparently at this point like a fringe top 10 pick. I watched a lot of Duke last year. Everybody does. If you watch college basketball, you kind of have to. He was, like, he didn't stand out. He averaged 5 points and five rebounds a game. He was, like, he changed some shots. But he couldn't really do anything yet. And so, like, what he's being drafted on is a series of, you know, tools that would be more readily assessed in a workout or through, like, a deep tape dive. But it kind of makes me feel stupid as a fan that so many of the guys that I was most struck by, not just like, you know, Drew Timmy types where you know they're a good college player, but you also know that the NBA is a different sort of skill level or athleticism level. There's a lot of these guys like on teams that I watched where I was kind of like, this wasn't even one of the guys on Arkansas that I noticed. And yet, you know, those guys are lottery picks apparently. So it's funny. Like, I'll probably get more Andy Rooney-ish about this as I get older. So you're asking me this question at the right time. I'm only going to get more annoying about it, I'm sure.
Couple of interesting pre-draft trades of Bradley Beal going out to Phoenix as they keep chasing the super team dragon, though it hasn't worked for a whole lot of people. And then the Celtics in the big three-way last night getting Porzingis, that they think is the answer to the lack of effort in the playoffs from Brown and Tatum.
How do you feel about Marcus Smart leaving?
I'm torn.
With you?
Well, I'm torn because I loved his passion. I think he was a great leader. You never had to question his effort, but there were also times when I would find myself unquestionably yelling at the screen when he would just fire up a three that he had no chance to make late in the game.
Yeah, it's a really weird type of player to be at that high level in the NBA. Like, you would think that a guy that has to be as good at the things as he's good at, and those are, you know, not just like in terms of defense, but in terms of like setting a tone in the clubhouse, which I'm sure is what Memphis has in mind with him. I mean, he fits well with like the team concept of like the last version of the Grizzlies. Like, he's a grit and grind guy, and they're a different team now. But he's definitely like a guy that if you're concerned about the culture of that roster, which I think is reasonable even after Dylan Brooks is out, so like he's the guy that you'd go to reset. I just know that like the Celtics fans that I know, it's exactly the opinion that you just described, where it is like they love him dearly. Also, a third of the time they wish that he had never been born, like when he's shooting, and it is hard to sort of square all of that. I get what the Celtics are doing to a certain extent. Porzingis was really, really good last year, and it's like easy to forget that because he was hurt so much and was kind of so up and down, you know, even by the end of his Knicks tenure. Like, he played in 65 games last year and he was great. That's a good guy to get. It's just the thing that I would worry about at the end of the season is that, like, if this is what the roster is going to look like, then they're counting on Robert Williams, Al Horford, Kristaps Porzingis, and I suppose still Brogdon to be there and be a part of the rotation when it gets to the playoffs. And, like, you know, if that doesn't happen, then I don't know that things end differently than they did this year.
We're talking with David Roth here on Downtown. Major League Baseball appears to be turning into the National Football League, where there are a couple of good teams, but most everybody else is pretty mediocre, but they'll go into August feeling like they've got a shot at making the playoffs.
That's what I'm counting on, man. As a Mets fan, that is all I've got right now. the idea, 'cause they are bad. They have been the third worst team in baseball since May 1st, and yet they're not completely out of it because even the good teams aren't. I mean, the Braves are very, very good. But in a lot of these other divisions, it's like I wrote about the Cardinals over the weekend, and like they are, you know, they had the fourth or fifth worst record in the league. And yet, like, you couldn't say that they're out of it in the National League Central, not just because there aren't that many good teams in it either. It's just that, like, there's so little separation below, you know, like where the Rays are, like way on top of everybody else, that it's kind of, you know, it is NFL-y in the sense that it could be anybody that comes out of it. And it is also NFL-y in the sense that a lot of the teams that are notionally in the mix, like if you watch them, you're like, no, that's not a good team. That's not going to happen.
Yeah, it's a frustrating year.
I mean, I talk myself into it with the Mets, but it's a challenge.
It's the same thing with the Red Sox. I mean, they won six in a row, and you thought, okay, well, they'll hang around, they'll be in the hunt, and now they've lost two in a row, and they're on such a fine line because they don't have enough pitchers. They had to start a guy today, Justin Garza, as their opener. He lasted an inning and gave up three runs because half their pitching staff is on the DL, and several of them probably won't be back this year, like Chris Sale.
Yeah, yeah, and it's been sad too. I mean, obviously taking a chance on Kluber doesn't look good now. Oof. I like the idea of that. Like anytime a team, yeah, I mean, it's a shame, but when it goes, it goes. You know, like it's not the sort of thing where you can look at that as like a failure of the coaching staff or whatever. You just can't get anybody out anymore.
And it's painful to watch. I feel for the man. You see the look on his face when he can barely hold a 10-run lead the other night in relief. And it's like watching Rick Ankiel when he couldn't find the plate anymore.
Yeah, that was the one where he got a 3-inning save in which he allowed 3 home runs.
Yeah, exactly.
It was a real... It's nice to end your career with an authentic statistical oddity on your record. It's weird. I wrote about Noah Syndergaard earlier this year, and there's something about guys that were at the level. I mean, Kluber was a Cy Young winner. I mean, he was like really one of the best pitchers in the sport for not a long enough period of time that he's in the Hall of Fame conversation, but for, 3 or 5 years, he was identifiably one of the best people on earth at this incredibly difficult task. And a guy like that sticking around long enough to be shelled the way that he is, most of the times when a pitcher gets to 300 wins, all of those guys get their butts kicked at the very end. Like even Maddox, even Roger Clemens, everybody stays around too long. That's a baseball thing. But it's tough to see Kluber. Like there's a part of me that, I want him to be happy. I want him to figure it out. I always enjoyed watching him and stuff, but it's tough that, surely he remembers when he was the best pitcher on earth, and then to be the guy now that is like the absolute like bulk blowout guy on a team that has an already decimated pitching staff, like there's something like poignant about it. If you're not a Red Sox fan, it's probably infuriating.
Yeah, it puts a little of both there. So you tweeted about this, and of all the things that are burning down on the planet here, this one has really got me mad because I watch. When the TV's on, I'm watching sports, occasionally little news, but then it's TCM. And to watch what's happening after this Warner's takeover of Turner Classic Movies, it's killing me because I love what they've done for film history.
It's the best channel we've got. There's obviously not a lot of competition anymore, but it is authentically still like weird, interesting movies that are very hard to find anywhere else. And that, beyond being like valuable, it's valuable if you care about movies, it's probably less valuable if you don't. It's just like knowing, I think that this is like, for me maybe, like I care about the channel, I don't watch it as much as I probably might, but it fits to me in the same sort of like the degradation of stuff. That there is like that things are going away in a way that like I think that the promise of the internet or of the sort of the way that we can store information now, terabytes of information, it used to be like, do you remember that there was a fire on a studio lot? This was some years ago. Where a great many masters of movies just went on because it's like the most flammable stuff there is. It was like old films in their canisters and an archive just burned up.
Right.
And those movies are like, they're not, they don't exist in any other form anymore, and so effectively they're gone. And I don't know what they were. It may not matter. They're like hearing all these like silent movies are now completely. Some percentage, like 80% of the silent movies that were ever made, are just gone. No one will ever see them. Like it doesn't matter to me in the sense that like I want to see those movies and now I can't. But there's something about the way that Zaslav, who's the head of the new Warner Brothers Discovery, has been cavalier with films that that they made. Like he treated Batgirl with a great deal of disrespect. I wasn't going to see that movie, but the idea of just bagging a movie for a tax write-off that you produced and made is like, it's a decision, and maybe it's justifiable from a business perspective or whatever, but it strikes me as like vandalism. It's months of people's lives. Some people would have wanted to see it, and then just to say like it's not worth it to us, it's bad in that instance. And then the idea of like Turner Classic Movies, which is really like the last place that most people would be able to see this sort of thing, because there aren't video stores anymore, because there isn't really like a DVD or like Blu-ray marketplace beyond like some very niche areas. Like that is all of the things that he's done in terms of like the whole turning HBO Max into Max and like making the general sort of like tenor of all those networks, 40% cheesier and dumber. All of that strikes me as somebody who doesn't have like basic respect for film and television. And I don't know how you wind up in that business if it's something that you don't care about. I mean, I do know, but it's a drag.
Yeah.
I think a lot of lay people do care about it and kind of count on it being there. And it doesn't seem to matter to him very much whether that happens or not.
All right, we have to get to the world of politics at some point here. We've seen some strange creatures on the scene here in the last several years, and we've talked about a lot of them. I do not for a moment understand whatever is going on right now with Robert F. Kennedy Jr. I mean, I get the name, and I get why he's being propped up by people. What I don't understand is why anybody who just doesn't want to use him as some kind of a wedge to hurt Biden would have any interest in this crazy person.
I'm not sure that anybody does have any interest. This is what I'm telling myself anyway. This is the tune that I whistle past the graveyard. There was a polling number that showed people were interested in him, and it's like, you know, his name is Robert Kennedy. You could see what Democrats might be interested in there. As a candidate, you know, or as just like as a public figure or whatever, he's one of those guys where the more you know about him, the less you like him. It's not even like a, you know, Ron DeSantis thing where like he's a bad politician, but also he's just like so not my type of guy that I can't make a rational assessment of him. Like it is just, it's like the sound of someone squeezing bubble wrap every time I hear him talk. Like it's just wrong. Whereas with Kennedy, he can't be normal for 30 seconds. He's not a normal guy. And he's not like, not only is he not a candidate, like he doesn't have politics or anything like that beyond not believing in the germ theory of medicine and having some, you know, elaborate conspiratorial justification for every single thing that's happened in the last 60 years. There are people that believe that for sure. And I know that I used to work with people, not at any of the websites I worked at, but a different job, who were pretty ardently anti-vax. They loved him. They loved the Dell Big Tree guy, who's like one of his big supporters and is another person in that scene. Those guys are such charlatans and such kind of like unconvincing performers that, again, maybe I'm just telling myself this, I don't think a normal person could stomach a few minutes of it. It's incomprehensible. But the idea that we're all going to get like sort of stuck with Kennedy because the media is bored with Biden and unsure how to deal with Trump, those ideas just being mainstreamed like this, I guess it's good that they're hearing them coming out of the mouth of like one of the most unsettling personal like human beings imaginable. But I could really do without this doesn't seem like a good time to be questioning the germ theory of medicine, for instance, or disease.
Let me ask you about Chris Christie. Is he smarter than all the Republicans and I think being ahead of the curve and going after Trump, or is it just his personal animus for the man that he can't hold off anymore?
That's the mystery of Chris Christie. It's why he's such a beguiling performer. It's why he's America's sweetheart. Is that everybody, you know, you see him and I must know more. What makes this man tick? This loud man shouting at a school teacher from behind his security detail. I must understand the inner workings there. It's amazing to me that anybody is falling for what he is out there doing at this point. The thing that I would underline with Christie is that he is smarter than the other candidates in the sense that he knows he's not going to win, and yet he also knows that there is a great deal of ground to be made up in terms of salvaging his personal reputation for whatever that's worth by being the one Republican who's willing to be like, this guy keeps doing crimes and that's going to really hurt us. Everybody else has to do this other weird qualified thing because they're Christie, I will say this, I don't think is angling for a job in the next Trump administration. And I think basically everyone that's running against him, with the exception of DeSantis, is. And so I don't want to speculate on Trump being electable or not. Christie, I think, knows that he isn't. And at this point is basically, earning some sort of like pundit points. If such a Republican ever becomes desirable on TV again, he's a decent communicator. And he is, you know, as a retail politician, pretty lousy, if we're being honest, but still better than a lot of these guys. So if cable news ever wants to start putting Republicans on who say anything other than Mr. Trump is being treated very nastily and unfairly, like, Christie is not a bad talker, and he is for sure a conservative Republican. I just don't think that him, he's not like a guy that's going to really convince anyone. Like, so he's just going to make it difficult for people in Upper New England. You're going to have to deal with seeing him on your TV a little bit for the next few months. And I'm sorry about that. I've had the experience, and I know it's bad.
I think
sooner or later we'll be rid of him.
It's a diversion. We'll take it. All right. I have to ask you this, and look, I will say this too. It's hard for me to do it, but I do subscribe as much as I can to the idea that any man's death diminishes me, and yet I'm finding it hard to feel a great deal of compassion for the people on that submersible.
Oh, yeah. Well, they made a really dumb choice, is the thing, to go on the submersible. The stuff that so when I first heard about it, and this is a real weird thing that this would have survived. I mean, the last few years have been a great time for realizing that everybody that, or more or less everybody, that is putting themselves out there as like a great innovator who has finally cracked the code on X, Y, or Z. Almost always those people are liars and have not done anything like that. You know, that like, so you'd think in like sort of a post-Elon world, you would look at anybody doing something really strange and dangerous. My first thought would be like, wow, that seems stupid. But instead, you know, because like James Cameron's down to the Titanic like 33 times. I was like, probably somebody else can figure out how to do it safely. The people that were running that tour or that organization or whatever seemed so incredibly cavalier about how dangerous the ocean is that I honestly wonder how they made it to the stage where they got to die in a submersible. Like, it seems like to hear these interviews where they're sort of like, well, you know, whatever, like, so it wasn't waterproof to 4,000 feet and we were going to 4,000 feet. What does that mean? It's not important. Like, what's important is mindset. It's like, no, it's important that your thing not collapse like a 7-Up can as soon as it gets below a certain level of the ocean. Like, you can definitely die down there. A lot of people have. And the weird kind of like, I mean, it is like libertarian in its form and also in its content, but people that make it to like late middle age having the view of the world that like a libertarian 16-year-old does, I almost can't be mad at them. I don't understand where that comes from, but it's almost admirable to me. Like, there's just like, so you didn't learn a single thing for 30 years. That is remarkable.
Well, I think it's pretty likely that James Cameron's journeys to Titanic weren't in a submarine designed by this guy, Stockton Rush. I mean, I assume you probably have seen this, but I don't know that our listeners have. A direct quote from him: you know, at some point, safety is just a pure waste. I mean, if you want to be safe, don't get out of bed. At some point, you're going to take some risks, and it really is a risk-reward question. I think I can do this just as safely by breaking the rules. I'm not going to get in a vehicle, any vehicle with this guy, let alone a vehicle that's going, you know, 13,000 feet below the ocean or whatever that it was supposed to do, you know.
What's crazy about that is I think that's a really good quote to have read out loud, too, because that's what I was kind of trying to get at. Is like, when you hear it said like that, you're like, I'm not going to make eye contact with this person. I'm going to just politely keep it moving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's basically, there were a lot of people that said that about safety during the pandemic and stuff, where they were sort of like, you know, like, got to live your life. You know, you got to be like, if you wanted to be totally safe, you'd stay at home, hunkered down. Is that what you want forever? And it's like, well, no, I want a third thing. There's two options. You know, there's more than two options in this case. Like, in terms of, if I wanted to go see the Titanic, which, like, honestly, you know, I'm not going to turn it down necessarily. I want to come back to the surface and live. Like, I'd pay extra for that, honestly. Like, that's a big part of the experience for me. You know, and so the idea that this guy, just because he, you know, believed in himself and never gave up, was, you know, just sort of like, I think that there's actually some crucial things about how physics works that I understand and that the previous few thousand years of human history got wrong. Like, you know, I salute the self-belief, but like, I will decline my ticket politely on a craft designed by someone with that mentality.
I'm going to leave the studio at 6. I'm going to get in my all-wheel drive Subaru, put on my seatbelt, mostly drive the speed limit on my way home, and I will not feel an emptiness in my life because I wasn't living on the edge for those 15 minutes.
Right. That's the thing that I don't I guess it's like, I definitely understand the importance of taking risks in life, right? Like, I don't think of myself as a big chance taker, but I have in my professional life, my personal life. Everybody does. You have to. And, you know, it's brought me great happiness sometimes and other times less so. But, like, I've done it when I thought it was important. If this is the sort of, like, in terms of taking a great risk with an extremely expensive vacation, I would use a different series of, like, you know, matrices to, like, assess all of that. The idea that this is, like, that if you believe in taking risks and trying to be great, that you then must do that every day until you die in the ocean is really, that to me seems wrong. I think you're overdoing it there.
And the other part of it for me, and I was having this discussion earlier with some folks here at the station, is it's risk without any reward. You're not going to see anything that you can't see through a view screen that hasn't been done by remote submersible subs. Going down in this wasn't going to benefit yourself in any way or any other person. There was no research being done. It was just to do it because you could then say that you had done it.
Right. There's a great Simpsons gag where in the Frank Grimes episode where he's startled and dismayed to find that Homer has been to space, and Homer goes, "Haven't you been?" And I feel like this is a real "haven't you been" experience.
Yes.
Like, the idea of going, especially when you see what the thing itself looks like, which is basically like if you made a toilet paper roll out of stainless steel and then there was a window at one end of it, like, just clamoring around with a bunch of other rich dudes to look at something when, like, again, James Cameron has made documentaries about it, lavishly, beautifully photographed. Mm-hmm. Like, rent an IMAX theater and watch one of those there, and then just go home.
Yeah.
Like, you don't need to worry about being turned inside out by barometric pressure or whatever in the ocean as a consequence of having done so.
Which is how I try to live my life, frankly, is adhering
to
that.
Don't get turned inside out. It's a great way to start.
There you go. David Roth with us on Downtown. David, thank you. Always a pleasure. Enjoy the upcoming Independence Day holiday. And when are you coming to Maine? Is that later in the summer?
Later in the summer. We're going to southern Maine in July, in the middle of July, and then we'll be up around your latitudes in the end of August into September. So a little bit later than usual, but we've got the big plans. We're going to help my father-in-law do a yard sale, so that'll be fun. And nothing else for 3 weeks.
Excellent. Well, we'll probably talk with you between Maine visits then.
I hope so. And yeah, I mean, if I can come by Bangor, I'll interrupt your show.
Oh, that would
be... I don't know, start yelling about the Red Sox. But, thank you for having me, and I hope to talk to you all soon.